I mean, Catherine had two kids on TV. You can't script that. Well, you can, but she didn't. At least I don't think so. You'll have to ask her. On another note, I realized that devoting an entire chapter of this book to my dog and not my girlfriend might be a bad idea, and I take full ownership of it. But I think I'll be forgiven. It isn't indicative of my feelings in any way. I feel differently and strongly about both. But I mean, I met Lil Craig first. And Lil C, if you're listening to this, you were the catalyst for my human relationship to even happen, you little furry Buddha. In some part thanks to Lil C, I met my girlfriend Taylor. It was at a restaurant with Lil Craig, and she was fairly new in town, and I thought I had met everyone within 100 miles of Charleston. I saw her, and we were both with friends, and we just all got together and had a few drinks and laughs. She lied and told me she was a marine biologist who specialized in shark sex, so it was destiny that we come together. The next day, I left to travel throughout Mexico for 3 weeks, but we stayed in touch. During the coronavirus lockdown, we only had 2 or 3 quarantine fights, depending on who you talk to, and one was over a heated game of Monopoly. It's been an interesting and ultimately lovely adjustment for me, and a small taste of domestic bliss during this otherwise shitty global pandemic thing. I think Lil Craig helped me, dare I say, slow down, and that got me in the right mindset for a relationship. I hadn't been in a relationship for several years, so I had to readjust my lifestyle a little. But it's been really very nice. Once COVID-19 hit our shores and we started playing house, the experience was overall positive. One problem, and I'm not exaggerating, is that just like Lil Craig, she has superseded me in popularity. All my friends are going over my head and around my back to make plans. Then Taylor just tells me where to go and when, which is actually fine by me. She's beautiful, kind, caring, and a wizard in the kitchen. And she loves Lil Craig like no other, maybe more than me. She keeps threatening to dog nap him if something were to go awry. I hope it doesn't, for many reasons, not just because I may lose my dog. Look, I'm honoring the two most important mammals in my life. They've seen me at my worst and my best, and stayed with me even when I'm drooling on the couch half asleep on a Sunday afternoon. Neither of them have run away, not yet, anyway. You see, dear listener, I'm not all about selfish debauchery. Well, yes, in many ways I am. But I'm capable of more, and of embracing the burdens of being a normal, responsible adult slash human being. For you see, I've basically spent 40 years chasing my every whim, and now I've peered into the abyss of adulthood and the white picket fence of existence, and it didn't scare me. The point is that I'm happy today, right now. I'm trying to be present. Thanks, Dr. Jardine, my therapist. It's working for me, and in many ways, I have Lil Craig to thank. He lives in the moment, like most animals, and we should all try to be more like our dogs. There's a line that I love from the Elton John song, I guess that's why they call it the blues, that says, "Live for each second without hesitation and never forget I'm your man." When Lil C repeatedly jumps into a rushing river, which he has done often, even though he can't swim very well, I can't get mad at him. I've jumped into many a metaphorical rushing river, and I've managed to keep my head above water. This applies to human relationships, too. If I'm staying in on an extremely rare night, and Taylor is out on the town, I say dance on the bar and live in the moment. Just try not to embarrass me, yourself, or our relationship while you're spitting in the devil's eye, as they say. Really, the only thing she can do to embarrass me is show too much PDA, public display of affection, because I am not a PDA guy, unless I'm watching one of my buddies with a girl, because in that case, it's hilarious. In any case, projecting into the future with relationships is a fruitless task because there are just too many variables, and Lil C reminds me of that every single day, which in turn helps me in my relationship with Taylor, since it reminds me to stop worrying about what might happen and focus on right now. To use a corporate buzzword, it's a symbiotic relationship. In any case, I told one of my sober friends the title of this book, and he liked it, saying that lowering the bar is the key to life. He also said that there's a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous that goes like this, "Expectations are premeditated resentments." I love that. It means keep it simple and live in the now. I feel like that's how Lil Craig lives. So, I'm following his example and hoping that one day I can be as evolved as him. Top 5 Lil Craig moments. Number 1. Picking him up with Cameron. He was so little and scared when I put him in my car. And frankly, I was too. I was now responsible for his life. It was a totally exhilarating and vulnerable moment for us all. Number 2. The first month I had him, he violently barfed on my dad. Once I stopped laughing, sorry dad, I picked him up and he barfed on me. My dad and I took little Craig to the pet hospital at 2 a.m. It's kind of neat because I was with the man who probably took me to the hospital several times as a child. So it was a generational thing of sorts, coming full circle. Poor little Craig got a shot of saline in his back, causing him to swell so that he looked like Quasimodo, aka the Hunchback of Notre Dame. Number 3. Let me be clear. I think dudes who get dogs to get chicks are douchebags. That being said, it does work. I went to a dog-friendly music festival called Wolfstock and got 3 different sets of numbers to arrange a play date. Those were good times before I met Taylor, and I have little Craig to thank. Number 4. Little Craig is good for business. A company called Farmer's Dog paid me, little Craig's counsel and executor, to do a couple Instagram posts, and it was not a small sum. I know what you're thinking, but I did not spend it. I put it in his college fund, in case he decides to follow in my footsteps and attend the University of Georgia one day. Number 5. In the morning when I wake up, well, mid-morning, he is curled up against my legs. He won't come when I want him to, and he thinks everything is always a game, but he must love me because he's always right there. When I come home, he's always at the top of the stairs, ready to give me an excited high five when I walk up. He truly is an incredible dog. Bachelor pad necessities. Besides having a dog as alluring as Lil Craig shuffling around your house, I have a few staples for a comfortable but not too fancy home. On this topic, I kind of am an expert. Number 1. A sectional and comfortable couch. I sleep on my couch half the time and I love posting up there for hours and maybe even days at a time. Number 2, no roommates. I haven't had a roommate since college, besides when Whitney and I shared a beach house. It's important to have a fortress of solitude. Number 3, a decently stocked wet bar and some mixers. Should be self-explanatory. Number 4, frozen pizza in the freezer and some soup in the cupboard. I'm no chef. Number 5, a well-performing and comfortable toilet will save your life. Also, a good shower with a little space and good flow. Number 6. If you live near a beach, try to build an outdoor shower. You'll thank me. Number 7. A decent-sized flat-screen TV and a reasonably good cable package with movie channels. I know everyone is off cable, but damn it, I'm a traditionalist on this one. Number 8. A guest room. It's always nice to be able to host friends from time to time. Number 9. Keep it minimal. Don't have too many nice things or conveniences. Keep it Spartan and simple. If you impress a girl too much, she may never want to leave. Number 10. And finally, and this can be tough, don't host parties. Attend them. Cleaning up sucks, and even the best-intentioned people treat your shit poorly. Chapter 9. Cancel me. I want to get something off my chest that might save a select few people a lot of time and energy. I've done and said things that make me cringe and that have literally made me toss and turn with embarrassment and regret. Nothing violent at all, but words can be weapons. So can an Instagram post. I am not asking you to pity me, just hear me out. As you know, if you've been listening to this book, I am from the South, and some would say the Deep South. My mom's family is from Montgomery, Alabama. My dad's is from Camden and Boykin, South Carolina. Thankfully, my relatives were well-educated, well-traveled, and compassionate, and I never heard words of prejudice in our household. But obviously, I didn't spend my life just in my own house. I went to boarding school in Virginia. I've spent lots of time hunting and fishing all over the region. Then I headed to college at the University of Georgia. You better believe I've encountered racism and bigotry since I was old enough to know what it was. I've done and said insensitive things in the past, a couple very public things, like the story I mentioned of posting an insensitive video on Instagram where I yelled "nice cans" at a homeless woman, but a whole lot more privately. In my youth, I've been around people who have uttered completely misogynistic, racist, and homophobic jokes, and I definitely have said a few myself. I am not proud of this. At the time, I/we thought it was funny to put other people down. It was mostly born of insecurity and pathetic attempts at humor and trying to be accepted into some invisible club. I also went to several parties in college and in my 20s where there were people in blackface. I've never done it myself, but I shook my head and I rolled my eyes. I rarely stood up to anyone who said or did something particularly cruel, although I do remember being defensive of kids who were picked on by friends and acquaintances. In Bible school as a little tyke, I attempted to beat up a kid who was 2 years older than me because he picked on my best friend, one of the few physical altercations I've experienced. Turns out the kid's mom was a teacher at the Bible school. Oops. I don't regret it, though. During my time, I'm sure I've done some picking on myself, mostly on my little brother and his friends, and Craig, the person, never the dog. Despite that, I can assure you everyone is alive and happy with each other at the present time. In truth, though, I've actually been on the other side of bullying, and it sucked. When I started boarding school, I was the new guy, and my roommate, T. Gill, was an athlete from Philly. He was a badass on the court and in the field, but he wasn't the nicest of dudes, at least initially. He and one of his buddies would pick on me pretty mercilessly, and it made me feel 2 feet tall. I didn't want to go back to my dorm room, which was my new home. Plus, it was my first time away from my parents. It wasn't fun, but I did learn from it, and he and I ended up becoming best buds, and we still love catching up today. He just had to get to know me and stop being so much of a dick. I've tried and am still working on erasing insulting words or phrases from my vocabulary, and I try to correct people who say things that I feel aren't okay. Again, I'm not saying I'm perfect or even close to it, but I'm trying to evolve, and I'll continue to do so. For the troll army and the keyboard warriors who want to spend time digging up dirt on me in order to cancel me, everything is already out there, and I am trying to get better. You don't deserve the probably ill-advised free research I've provided here, but you're welcome. I honestly think we cannot progress without an honest and frank discussion about things in the past and present that make some uncomfortable. In my opinion, to move forward, we have to be honest and open. And I believe cancel culture impedes this by making people scared to broach any discussion of prejudice. It's just too risky to be misinterpreted. This isn't what we should be doing. Open discourse and freedom of speech are at the center of our country. If you shame someone into silence, how are they going to learn? How are you? I'm not saying I'm a saint, far from it, but I do try to put some good into the world. I've happily donated to numerous charities. I've worked in soup kitchens in downtown Charleston delivering food. I've created friendships online with a bunch of service members and sent them lots of care packages in Afghanistan and Iraq. I've helped raise tens of thousands of dollars for local 14-year-old hero of mine named Sidney Fowler, who suffered paralysis and whose family needed to make their house more handicap-friendly. Hi, Sid. I've helped raise thousands of dollars for hurricane victims in the Virgin Islands and the Bahamas by selling Shep Gear hats and shirts. And I've arranged for a huge lumber company to send materials free of charge to the Bahamas to help them build again. Also, not that this is a tangible public good, and obviously it's hard to quantify, but I feel like Southern Charm maybe gives people in hospital beds or in the middle of particularly tough and depressing times a reason to just smile or get lost in some reality TV drama for a little bit. One of my best friends, Josh, passed away recently after a 3-year bout with cancer. And he wrote me this after the season 6 reunion last year. I had had a rough season and was getting it from all sides on social media. Hey buddy, thought you were great last night. The Bravosphere is clearly trying to play the hero/villain story and create some wild character arc with you. Let your light shine through all this shit. You are, at your core, an extremely intelligent human being and a force for good in the world. I appreciated your notation of the 6-billion-year-old planet we travel throughout the universe, and none of this bullshit really matters. Reality TV has people trapped in some kind of warped, true social media point-scoring syndrome. Anyway, I'm fighting my ass off to stay alive. I don't have a great prognosis, but rooting for you on TV helps keep my mind occupied and renders the needles and chemo bags less significant. You are a generous friend to your actual friends. Thank you for being my friend. Call me sometime when I'm in the hospital and let's share a laugh. Cheers. As I reread this and cry in the corner of a coffee shop where I'm writing on my computer, it is not lost on me that this wonderful and caring message from a friend was sent after a rough patch of mine on television while he was fighting for his life and full of tubes in a hospital bed. R.I.P. Josh Adams, one of the greats and a legend in my eyes. Now, maybe you're ready to send a hate tweet about me for thinking that Southern Charm could possibly be a force of good in the world. Maybe you've already sent the tweet. That's your problem. I'm not writing this to garner praise, but to show that people are fallible and imperfect. Except maybe Tom Hanks, aside from that Vegemite imbroglio. Some of us are resistant to change, and these people are the most dangerous and hard to fathom. I truly believe they're not all lost causes. Most of us are hopefully willing to change, improve, and evolve as human beings, and as society changes and people rightly voice their displeasure with the way things are or with certain words that hurt them. Sometimes it's things that other cultures didn't even consider, and we need to recognize that. This isn't safe zone talk, but just recognizing that something hurts another human being and doing your best to curtail those things is a positive change. This is something I'm paraphrasing from Sam Harris's Making Sense podcast. The definition of wisdom is recognizing the turmoil within yourself and zooming out on yourself and knowing that there are contradictions and trying to figure out those contradictions. Cancel culture is the opposite of this. It's zooming in on something and not taking things or people as a whole. For some reason, I'm reminded of the great book To Kill a Mockingbird. The little girl Scout Finch sees a white man who's part of a mob that's about to invade the prison and lynch a wrongly accused black man, Tom Robinson. She calls out this man's name in the mob and said that she's friends with his son at school. It stops everything and diffuses the situation, all because of a certain humanity expressed by a child. I think it's beautiful, and it's also my mom's favorite book and moment. It shows just how absurd the prejudices and hatred of adults can be. Prejudice and racism are learned behaviors, and maybe I'm foolishly optimistic, but I hope that we as a society become more accepting of each other and that hatred dies a little more each day. I know hatred and prejudice will never disappear, unfortunately. Some humans will always need to put others down to try and lift themselves up. That's a pragmatic view of things. Certain groups of people will need to think others are inferior so they don't feel like they're on the bottom rung of the ladder, when that mindset is actually what puts them there. And not to get too global and economic, but there are astounding wealth gaps and brutal discrimination all over the world, including our beloved America. Buffett, Warren, not Jimmy, has a quote that goes, "It takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it." He was talking about the former investment firm Salomon Brothers, but still. Now more than ever, he is right. And I think this is a big problem that we face, that of the cancel culture. In case you've been listening along and you still don't know what the phrase means, the trusty internetdictionary.com describes it like this. Cancel culture refers to the popular practice of withdrawing support for, canceling, public figures and companies after they've done or said something considered objectionable or offensive. It's generally discussed as being performed on social media in the form of group shaming. Now let me describe it as I see it. It's a demonization intended to end one's career slash standing and make them suffer great reputational or financial loss. And it's complete mob rule, with pitchforks and burning torches in the form of tweets and comments. Think Salem witch trials or McCarthyism. It often ignores context, nuance, spirited debate, and real discourse over inflammatory topics. And it blasts full speed ahead before considering if the actions or words actually did real damage. It's typically a bunch of self-appointed hall monitors or online policemen, and sometimes detectives. That's when they go back in time to uncover anything one has said over the course of their lives. They are hoping and praying for any sort of gaffe committed by someone with notoriety, and then they move on to the next victim. It gives anonymous people some feeling of agency and importance that intoxicates them. Let me be clear, though, because I've done a lot of thinking on the topic and I try to consider all angles. I also want to explore the causes and the people who embrace canceling. But first, a caveat. Some of you might say, but what about people like Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein? Don't they deserve to be canceled and worse? Believe me, I was elated to see those two get prosecuted in an actual court and in the court of public opinion. Those were real criminal cases with many victims coming out in public. To me, that's not cancel culture, that's justice. Cancel culture, to me, isn't about something criminal. It's about reputation or behavior, and it's often about the mob tearing someone down without a thought. If Cosby is a roaring fire, the cancel culture victim is a barely glowing ember, with a handful of people blowing on it and trying to add more wood. Sometimes it works and a full fire rages unnecessarily and without validity. And then people pick it up and just read the salacious headline and not the fine print, and it spreads and then someone is finished / canceled, when all it really might have been was a poor choice of words or actions that they could learn and grow from. But now they are toasted and roasted and there's no going back. Let us try to figure out how we got here, though. If you look closely, it isn't too difficult. I'm sure we are all familiar with the old saying from the network and print news, if it bleeds, it leads, which means cover the violent or scary subject first because fear gets clicks and views. That's what the viewer wants. It's the same mentality as rubbernecking when you pass by a wreck. In today's culture, there's absolutely zero shame when it comes to feeding salaciousness, outrage, gratuitous contrarianism, blood, guts, conspiracy theories, out-and-out lies, you name it. News is a business, and the name of the game is to not only reach as many viewers as possible, but to piss people off and get them angry, which then makes them more engaged and keeps them watching and retweeting. One night, I was reading an article online about Ariana Grande fans trying to cancel Lizzo over some perceived slight. Full disclosure, I know very little about either of these pop stars except for this. Supposedly, one of Lizzo's songs made a top 10 list, but Ariana fans said the only reason the song did so well was because Ariana Grande sang on the track. Awful insults were being lobbed by maniac Ariana fans. It was like a firestorm and very mean-spirited. Then I looked up at the TV to see NBC Nightly News, and Lester Holt said something like, "Coming up, why these 911 dispatchers who screwed up an incoming call are now getting fired." Just more outrage and blame to keep people watching and reading the news. People love these stories, whether they're about pop stars or 911 scandals, and I guess I do too. It's hard to look away. And who can forget the hilarious footage on the Weather Channel, where some of the correspondents look like they're on the verge of being sucked out of a fuselage at 30,000 feet, and then two guys walk by smoking a cigarette as if nothing is wrong. Or when there's a hurricane and they're telling everyone to stay inside or they will die. But then there's the correspondent in their rain jacket with their hair whipping in the wind as they risk their very life to tell you how everyone is going to perish. People tune in when violence, death, or desperation is on the horizon. The news, any and all kinds, feeds the people what they want, like a tiger getting red meat. And this is all a trickle-down effect straight from the top. We'll show you what to be outraged about. The more lurid, the better. I feel as if we're on the brink of the end of civility and maybe civilization. And when you take out civility and strip it away, you have a potential ticking time bomb. Lots of them, actually, just ready to explode. We are aware of the combustible environment that has been created, fostered, and squeezed for maximum profit. But who are the people who are the catalysts and want to be people of import, the bottom of the rung whistleblowers and haters? It should come as no surprise that they are from the extremes. And I'll get into that in a second, because there's definitely a big political component, which I'm about to attempt to tackle, much to the horror of my publisher. But first, I want to share a story I heard on the Howard Stern Show, my favorite, where he talks about this woman who was formerly in a hate group who turned her life around and who now does work with the less fortunate. What she said is that on a certain level, being in that group was about finding a sense of belonging. Yes, the ties that bound them were ugly and awful, but at the end of the day, it was about being part of a club. Before she got involved with the group, she was lonely, depressed, and unhappy. And then she joined and she was invited places. She started dating within the group and she felt accepted. I do believe there's a correlation here with the troll cancel culture world. If this woman had just been canceled and shamed, she probably wouldn't have been motivated to turn things around and do some good in the world. The problem with cancel culture is it never allows forgiveness, and it never gives people a chance to learn from their mistakes. Many of the people doing the canceling are deeply unhappy and dissatisfied with life. They want to feel important, useful, and noticed, even if what they're doing is ugly, irrational, hurtful, and destructive. They feel part of something. I love this alleged story about a professional boxer who was getting attacked on Twitter by some guy for God knows what. But the troll said some crazy things and even mentioned the boxer's son. So the boxer did a little research and found where the guy lived. He knocks on the door, ready to fuck this guy up, and the troll just breaks down and sobs as soon as he opens the door. He admits that he doesn't know why he said those things. He's just really unhappy. The boxer took pity on him and actually ended up trying to comfort him. I'm not sure if all online trolls are redeemable, but that story gives me hope, even if it's just a virtual urban legend. So now on to the political troll slash cancel culture breakdown, according to yours truly. You have the crazy right-wingers who are just rabid. The people who Trump was talking about when he said, I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters. They're the people who go to his rallies and wear the fuck your feelings shirts. But if you dare criticize their dear leader or just point out a shortcoming or gaffe, they get insanely aggressive, angry, and pugilistic. They call moderates or anyone on the left snowflakes, but goodness, they seem to have thin skin for people claiming to be so tough. They love saying triggered, thereby celebrating the fact that people are upset over a particularly cruel or idiotic deed, but they'll fly off the handle if a Dem screws up or insults a GOP leader. Then on the other side, we have the progressive crowd. I know that progressive has a generally positive connotation, and being open to change and new norms is a good thing. But some of these people are their own worst enemy, and they might just be the biggest and craziest faction of the cancel culture. They are offended by everything. They'll sift through anything and find something so obscure or inconsequential and latch onto it like a pit bull. And then they try to accumulate support and outrage via exaggeration and removal of certain facts or context. The danger of this is that it's like the boy who cried wolf syndrome. There are legitimate things that are outrageous and offensive, which should be addressed and changed. But when you yell and scream about everything, you lose the weight of some important messages. There's a loud faction of the left that is so idealistic that they won't accept the support of people in the middle, because their beliefs aren't as strong on various issues. It's crazy. One thing I know about this country is that you need the people in the middle to win elections. And if you don't win elections, there'll be little to no change in progress. Politics is give and take. You take two steps forward and one back. You decide what's most important and prioritize it. But don't shame others just because they have a different opinion. Don't get excited or horrified. I have no plans to run for office or become a politician. This is just a topic that I feel passionate about, as you can see. Despite my philosophy of living up to average expectations, that's always been more about career and personal choices. The expectation for me, my siblings, and my cousins was to be good human beings and listen to and consider other people's opinions and views and backgrounds. In that regard, being as good a citizen of the world as you possibly can, while also knowing that mistakes will be made and perfection is unattainable, has been an unspoken mantra in my life. So even though I'm a proponent of lowering the bar when you can and living a gloriously average life, becoming a more enlightened and understanding and accepting human being, one who does not cancel people without really digging into the facts and who takes time to hear someone out, is one area of life where I say, strive to be better than average. Or at least try for average, plus one. P.S. After my own brush with cancellation, when I posted the Nice Cans Instagram story that ignited the masses, I wrote this in the Notes app on my phone. I'm not sharing it to garner praise, but just to give you a glimpse into what it was like. As I drive to Charlotte to get on a plane to Alaska, I keep replaying things in my head. The last thing I want is sympathy, but it's been rough, and today I met up with some fans while grabbing a sandwich, and it was nice and gave me a rare moment of relief. They don't care. They don't follow gossip sites. They've enjoyed you on TV and you've made them smile. I did everything wrong from the very beginning and I just re-examine it over and over again. 1 minute you can be weird and try to be funny a little bit walking down the streets in New York and have a little audience with you, and then bam, wrong decision, situation, all of it. But damn, the rage response is so hateful, so mean. Saying I should kill myself and I'm the scum of the earth. How does this add up? Sort of a two wrongs don't make a right situation? Creating a pretty damn ironic situation, which is, I bet many of the cancel culture people think they are protecting a victim or acting on their behalf in a good way. And in doing so, they've become the predator. Chapter 10. Happy Accidents. My life has pretty much been a series of happy accidents, and Southern Charm is no exception. I had no idea that going to a rooftop party in Charleston one night all those years ago would lead to me meeting Whitney and then being on TV. Back then, nobody could have predicted the show's popularity, at least nobody on the cast. Most of us just thought we were trying something out for a laugh and we'd be back to regular life soon enough. But here we are. The first Southern Charm-related happy accident for me was running into Thomas Ravenel at that rooftop party on New Year's Eve and then having him introduce me to Whitney Sudler Smith. My interview for the job of being on Southern Charm was pretty much just to be myself, get drunk, and go to a strip club. I didn't need my wildly embellished resume or even a suit and tie, so maybe it was fate. If the job fits, do it as long as you can. From the moment I met him at that fateful party, Whitney and I connected immediately. I just think he's a completely unique and hilarious person. Sometimes I describe him as a guy who's content to be miserable. Nothing is ever up to his specifications and lofty standards, but he's so funny about it that you almost look forward to his discontent. He is also extremely generous. One of my favorite things about him, besides the fact that he's known for picking up tabs, is that he'll call you up on a Wednesday and say, "Dude, come to Ibiza. We have a villa there. It's going to be epic." So I'll tell him that sounds great and ask when he's going. And he'll say something like, "This Friday." I know my love for travel might make me sound adventurous or like I'm some global jet setter, but flying to Spain on a whim isn't how I roll. I need to think about it and plan a little. So regrettably, I had to turn Whitney down about 5 times in a row, since dropping $3,000 on a last-minute ticket stings. Eventually, I did take him up on one of those offers because I was afraid he'd stop asking. He invited me to the Berlin Film Festival with a 1-week notice, and I said yes. Let's just say I didn't see a single film and barely saw much sunlight. Berlin was a really cool city, though, sort of gloomy and gothic, and I loved it. I actually think Whitney is my dad's favorite person on the show. There's a scene in season 2 where Catherine bitches Whitney out on the porch on Jekyll Island, and the next morning Whitney is quietly trying to escape, and he's peeking around corners and sneaking around. My dad couldn't stop laughing because he said it reminded him of Peter Sellers in The Pink Panther. If someone wrote a fictional script depicting everything that has happened on the show, no one would believe that people like us actually existed. Take Thomas. I mean, he's outrageous, he's flawed, he's larger than life, and absolutely unpredictable. He can be charming as hell 1 minute, then angry as hell the next. One thing he always does is apologize, though. I can't count how many mean texts I've gotten from him at midnight, but I just learned to ignore them and wait for the contrite apology the next day, which I happily accept. I have mixed emotions about his absence from the show. I won't get involved with the details because it's none of my business, but I'll just say this. He put himself in a really bad position and paid for it, and he's done that a couple times. I wish him well, though, and miss talking to him about whatever he was passionate about that day or night. I also hate seeing his lingering anger and his lashing out at Patricia, since they were once very close friends and shared a lot of laughs. I do think Thomas convinced himself that she was the architect of his demise, which is absurd in my opinion. He torched the bridge between them and he continues to firebomb it, which saddens me. As for Cameron, Craig and I first met her at a restaurant called 39 Rue de Jean. I had just moved to Charleston, and Cameron had just decided to do the show. I remember thinking how beautiful and funny she was, a mix of sass and grace. I immediately wondered if I had a shot. She touched my leg over 5 times at the bar when she was telling stories and laughing. In my experience, the leg touch is a tiny positive gesture that has been the precursor to many a home run. Unfortunately, I looked over and she was doing the same thing to Craig. So maybe this was the beginning of our rivalry. It turns out that's just the way Cam is. She's touchy-feely and southern and sure of herself. As fate would have it, she was already dating her now husband, Jason, at the time. How could I compete with a doctor who had a classic Ferrari and who made his own beer, and who was reserved, thoughtful, and a great listener? She chose wisely. I've watched Cam become a married woman with a child and a big house. It happened before my very eyes. Even though he'll deny it, I actually think Craig has come the furthest of all of us. His evolution could be summed up by the simple phrase, know thyself. Or better yet, embrace your eccentricities. Or, as Shakespeare wrote, and our old friend Polonius remarked, to thine own self be true. Craig finally stopped lying to everyone all the time and came clean about what he did and didn't want to do with his life. He didn't want to be a lawyer. He wants to make pillows, which I wholeheartedly support. In case you missed it, there was an episode where Craig mailed a blank, fake application to the South Carolina Bar Association, so I'd think he was on top of his shit, which is actually hilarious looking back, but completely and utterly unnecessary. I mean, with the time and effort put into looking like he was applying for the bar exam, he probably could have legitimately done it. I once walked into his apartment and he commented he'd been up since 8:30 in the morning taking care of things. What the things were is anyone's guess. But one of his roommates overheard that and later came to me and said Craig didn't wake up until noon. Why would I care what time he woke up? I wake up late and I don't think I need to remind everyone how important I think sleep is. It's everything. These stupid little white lies were intended to make him appear to have his shit together. I would call him out and we'd squabble. But the thing is, those lies start piling up, and then things go sideways. And then you got to keep all the lies straight. It becomes a house of cards. We've all been train wrecks at one time or another on the show, but the ultimate was season 2 for Craig. He got fired from his job, which you saw on the show, but he also did things like leave his car at the Charleston airport for 90 days. At first he forgot it was there, so then he got a ride home. Then he procrastinated, and then he didn't have the money. It became an 800-pound or $800 gorilla situation. When we went to get his car finally, it was like $850 to get out, but that wasn't all. When he parked it downtown in front of his apartment that evening, he woke up to find it with a boot on it and a ticket saying he owed $500 in late parking tickets. To top it all off, he was sucker punched and knocked out on Halloween, and he cracked his skull on the sidewalk and had to go to the hospital. That part wasn't funny, and I'm glad it wasn't worse. So it was a rough few months for my friend. I thought he got off rather easily considering all the follies and ridiculous behavior, but whatever. My point is, Craig has come a long way. I trust him implicitly now. He tells the truth and owns his peccadilloes and strangeness. He sews. I guess you can call him a seamsman. And he's good at it. I like the designs. He stays focused. It's great. He also had the boldness to move to the Bahamas because he was falling into some habits he didn't like in Charleston, and he met some cool people and got a different perspective on life. I went down there to visit and loved every minute of it, except for the one fight we got into where I threw a cooked steak at his face. It was probably our biggest fight, but we made up about 18 hours later. I was pissed because I felt like he was trying to make me look bad in front of his friends. It didn't help that we had been on a boat pounding beers in the sun all day. The point is, I actually listen to Craig's advice these days. He has some valuable and helpful insights over the years, and I value that. I'm not saying he should actually practice law and leave the pillow empire, but it's way more plausible than it was 4 years ago. I think the best way to describe Craig's metamorphosis is this. Austin, Craig, and I share a personal trainer named Brian, aka Swoley Mammoth. We train together, or Austin and I train and Craig sometimes shows up. Our text chain is called Biceps for Bravo. Anyway, one time Craig out of the blue said he was going to join us the following day, so we got excited. The next morning, we were getting ready for the 11 a.m. session, and we got a text at 10:30 a.m. from Craig saying, "Guys, I can't make it. I have a mani-pedi appointment at 11:30. It was the only time she could fit me in." The point is, he's owning the weirdness and embracing it. He's painting his fingernails blue, designing pillows, and going on tour to interior design stores across the East Coast. Go, Craig, go. The truth shall set him free. I love Craig 3.0, or is it 4.0? However many there have been, this version is my favorite. And then there is Catherine. Oh, Catherine, I do love and root for her, but she does make it hard at times. I first met Catherine when we started filming the first season. She wasn't officially a cast member, but she was being invited to many of the functions we were filming. It was very obvious to me that she wanted to be in front of that camera. And why not? She's darn good at it. She's 6 feet tall with wild red hair. You can't not notice her. I remember once she came out to hang at the beach with me and my fun non-show friends, and they instantly liked her. She's funny and irreverent. The first season, she wasn't officially part of the cast, but she was Thomas's girlfriend, and she quickly became part of the scenes, and then the show. I think she naturally took to it and became a major cast member. That girl is strong-willed. Also, without revealing too much, I had a wonderful time with Catherine during our brief affair. I remember walking out to the Battery downtown and sneaking a couple glasses of wine and dangling our legs over the seawall. I remember reading my favorite passages of books to her out loud on my couch, and I remember her writing me a 4-page note and leaving it on my coffee table one morning. The note was so nice and raw and real, it still makes me feel warm and fuzzy to this day. I also remember tearing each other's clothes off. Oh, wait, I said I wouldn't reveal too much. She was lovely, and I do believe I had a calming influence on her, and maybe still do. I always see her as the girl laughing at my dumb jokes and letting her guard down to reveal a very sweet and complex person. But boy, can Catherine be her own worst enemy as well. She's got a short fuse that causes her to fly off the handle. She lets her passion get the best of her, and it turns her into someone else at times. She forgets who her friends are and turns inward, believing that everyone is out to get her and she can't trust anyone. She and Thomas were like gasoline and fire. Still, we had happy accidents occur on the show with the birth of their two children. At least I believe it was an accident. They sure seemed to indicate that it was. I would be completely dishonest if I didn't give a huge amount of credit to both of them for our show's success. I mean, what fan isn't going to keep watching after babies are born on TV? Plus, I always joke that Catherine is the patron saint of scorned women. Hell hath no fury. As for Austin, I met him through my good friend Bailey. He would have these wild late nights at his place back in the day, and we just hit it off. He's an affable dude chasing women and drinking beer, so we had very parallel interests. Plus, he's a Fish fanatic, and I love them too, so how bad can a guy be if he loves great music? When friends ask me what Austin is like in real life, I simply say he went to 13 Fish shows in a row in New York City once. And they usually just nod, acknowledging that he's one of us. I lobbied hard to get him on the show when they were looking for new people. I thought he would counterbalance Craig's sensitive nature, and we all might have a lot of fun acting up together. Well, that's been proven to be true, but I must admit I failed to properly assess Austin. Hell, he's just as sensitive and emotional as Craig, if not more so. Sometimes we all fight or gang up on each other, but we never carry the anger around for more than about 30 minutes. You'll usually find us all laughing shortly after a blow-up. The matriarch of the show is obviously Patricia. She's Whitney's actual mom, but she is my mom away from home. I love her. She's extremely generous with the parties she throws and the meals and nice bottles of wine she shared with me. She's generous of spirit. If you called and asked her to do something or help you with anything, she is always game. My parents came to visit Charleston when the show was still new, and Patricia had us to the house for cocktails. It went well, and we all chatted and laughed and talked about her Virginia roots and her life experiences. It was a great time. Well, the next day my mom called me and said, "I'm worried for Patricia." I asked why on earth she was worried. She said, "I worry about the way she's portrayed on TV. She's just so nice and lovely, and that doesn't always come across on your show." I had to laugh. My mom was worrying about my other mom. I assured my actual mom that Patricia can handle it, and I thought she relished her role on the show as sort of the snarky and somewhat ostentatious queen bee. I'm not saying she's playing a role, but she can turn it on sometimes, and I think the viewers love it when she does. What everyone doesn't see is when Whitney's home, and they invite me over, and we eat fried chicken or some vegetarian chili in the TV room with our feet up laughing about some ridiculous rumor or whatever. She really is one of the guys sometimes. She doesn't even wince at our vulgarities like my real mom would. Like any show, we've had people come and go over the years. I hated to see good friends like Cameron leave, but things change and evolve, and so does the show. I wish her all the happiness in the world, and we communicate often, and we both have expressed that we'll be friends until we are old and gray, and that makes me smile. I miss Chelsea and Naomi too, and will always consider them friends. I thought Chelsea brought a down-home feeling and real southernness to the table. I thought and still think she's great. Chelsea, if you're reading this, I'll meet you for a surf session in Nosara very soon. Naomi lost her dad, and she had also fallen in love, and I don't think she wanted to share all of that on TV. She chose family over filming, and how can that ever be wrong? I wish her the best and will always enjoy running into her and eating amazing meals at her family's restaurant, Nico. And then there's me. Obviously, I'm still coming back for more. When the show first started filming, I was a total piece of clay on camera. I had no idea how it all worked. Filming a TV show was a little like learning a new language, but it's a collaboration that I came to really like. It's a good feeling when you see things fall into place and it seems like they're really working. I remember when we were filming the first season, and I had some witty banter going on, and I thought what I was saying was the most clever, hilarious thing ever uttered on television. I quickly learned to check my ego, but I had and still have a hell of a lot of fun going back and forth with my friends. Maybe I was naive, but naivety and optimism can be a strength. There have been moments when I feel like something is funny and compelling, and it gives me a sense of pride. That's one of the main reasons I'm still doing the show. There have been a number of events that have occurred on the show over the years that you just couldn't even make up. These outrageous and unpredictable things have, in my opinion, compelled viewers to stay tuned in year after year. Just as no one could have predicted the show's success, no one could have foreseen the attention and sometimes harsh criticism we all eventually receive. None of us knew how to deal or cope with it all. After all, we weren't in LA or New York, poking around the entertainment industry, savvy about PR or how to play the game. Except for Whitney, who was in that world, we all learned on the fly, with varying degrees of success. We all got our comeuppance at one point or another, sometimes twice. Sometimes fully deserved, sometimes the result of a slight misunderstanding. I genuinely think that every person who has been on our show is redeemable and essentially good. Well, maybe not Thomas's ex-girlfriend, Ashley. What I'm saying is, everything isn't always as it appears on our show. Although I'll put my hand to my heart as far as the veracity of our actions are concerned. We are not actors, and we are not faking it. Sometimes it's tough for us to know the full story. But it's like that in everyday life sometimes too. You hear something about a friend, a rumor starts, and before you know it, a story has gotten out of hand. So, if you watch the show, please keep this in mind before you take to Twitter and tell us you wish we'd die or whatever level of hate you are serving up. Just take a deep breath and think about the context and zoom out on any one of us. Might there be a reason for a disparaging comment? Is there a pattern of cruel behavior in the past? Is the person a shit talker and mudslinger by nature? By the way, this should extend to all our real lives as well. The benefit of the doubt is the best way to approach most situations. But I guess every story needs a villain. No one would watch a movie or a TV show if it was about a bunch of people who are polite and nice and reserved 100% of the time. I think most of us see the show as being a lot of fun, as I believe most of you do. So we would like to keep making y'all laugh and or pull your hair out, or both, for many years to come. Chapter 11. Last Laughs. As I've referenced several times over the course of this book, I really enjoy writing. Wait, let me rephrase that. Once I sit my hyper ass down and remove the 1 million distractions from my head and get on a roll at the keyboard, I really enjoy writing. I used to read Bill Simmons' articles religiously when I was in my 20s, and here was this guy talking sports and writing about ridiculous trips to Vegas with his buddies, and I thought, I've got some of those stories to tell. On a higher level, sorry, Bill. I love David Foster Wallace, and his work had a huge impact on me. He was a hilarious writer, and I read his essay, A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, when I was on a plane, and it made me laugh so hard the guy next to me thought I was crying and hyperventilating because I was upset. Really, I was just entertained by words on a page, and that seemed like a pretty good goal. I love to entertain people, so why not do it with words as well? Then one day, as I was pursuing my average but always interesting, to me anyway, life, I got the chance to actually write a book. I found myself in New York City, where I was asked to attend a cool party during Fashion Week. I know, rough stuff. During that trip, I met with my publisher. Hi, guys. And when I walked into the building, I was legit in awe. As a book lover, I was freaking out about the framed photos of famous books that lined the halls and imagining the authors who had walked there before me. It was amazing. I was ushered into a conference room and met with six welcoming people, and because I was in such awe, and also still kind of buzzed from the fashion part of the previous night, I just rambled on about everything and anything. A few times they cut in with an idea and I just nodded and agreed and plowed on, trying to be funny. I sat down to write, and when I sent the first page to my agent, she immediately wrote me back and said, "You realize that you agreed to do a certain type of book in the publisher's office, right? This isn't that book." Oh, crap. What had I, in my nervous, hungover state, agreed to do? I think I just rambled on that day and agreed to everything without hearing anything because I just wanted them to like me. The pressure was real. Turns out I committed to write a tongue-in-cheek guide to being a Southern gentleman. What? No. I had important things to say, damn it. This was a serious affront to my pseudo-intellectualism. Maybe that book would have become a mega success, but it wasn't me. I'm on a show called Southern Charm, but I am no expert on being a Southern gentleman. Although I do know how to behave at dinner parties, sometimes, and weddings, occasionally, and important events, maybe? The point is, that wasn't me, and I didn't want to give you guys a phony version of myself. What you've just heard is pure 100% Shep Rose, unfiltered and semi-uncensored. I actually started writing this book during the initial coronavirus quarantine in South Carolina. If you harbor a desire to write and you're not able to do it while stuck at your home for months, you probably should aim for another passion. I genuinely love the experience, which might cause some writers to hate tweet me since for many writers, I know the process can be torturous. I often laughed out loud while writing and remembering certain stories, and I certainly loved polling my family and friends for any minor insanity that I may have missed. Looking over old emails and report cards and postcards that my mom had saved over the years gave me endless joy. But more than that, writing this really gave me a great sense of purpose, accomplishment, and responsibility. I know I have a reputation of being a dilettante, and I could go into detail about a lot of the things I work on and am enthusiastic about when we aren't filming. But I won't do that to you now. You're almost at the finish line. Plus, defending yourself to trolls is like pissing into the wind. So just know that this has given me a sense of purpose and focus, which, for a 40-something man who could add gallivanting and revelry sections to my resume, is a major accomplishment. Often over the past year or so, I've spoken to my therapist and told her what I'm up to professionally and what I'm excited about. I can be my harshest critic, because let's face it, as much as we say we don't listen to the haters, of course we all do. But my therapist was quick to tell me, listen, you're writing a book, you're about to film another season of your show, you're excited about a scripted show you've created and are working on with writers in LA. You're designing and selling shirts and hats for Shep Gear. What more do you want? Her tough love helped, especially when I thought about the book. I have a tangible piece of evidence of my hard work and passion here. I can feel it and touch it and hold it and sleep with it under my pillow and send it to friends and use it for kindling. Wait, strike that last one. In short, this feels good, and that's one of my most important life philosophies. If it feels good, do it. Think of me as the Socrates of leisure. So maybe this book will fulfill or exceed my own average expectations, and gasp, raise the bar? I really just hope I can come away from it feeling like I've made my friends and family laugh a little and swell with pride. Never mind that my nieces and nephews won't be able to read it until their late teens, or maybe their early 20s. I don't want to send them on the same dangerous and idiotic expeditions I went on, armed only with foolhardy and irresponsible philosophies. Although it worked out okay for me. I originally wanted to call this book You Can't Lasso a Zebra, because since I came from this pretty traditional Southern background, there's that old assumption that you get married, join the country club, have kids, get involved with the PTA, and then you die. And I just never even came close to that, yet. Turns out that apparently zebras can't be domesticated. The zebra can't be lassoed because it has been conditioned to basically have 360-degree vision so as not to get eaten by predators. I'm not saying I have 360-degree vision, but I do have 20/20 vision. Plus, I just love roaming the plains unfettered and carefree, with full knowledge that lions lurk behind every patch of grass. So, thanks for taking a look under the hood of the car that is me. I sure hope you were as entertained listening to it as I was writing it. And if you like it, tell a friend to listen to it. I'm definitely not saying this book should be a guideline for any of you, but maybe a devilish smile and a dollop of adventurousness with a side order of insanity can be added to your dinner plate. Because at the end of the day, or the night, or at dawn when you're stumbling home, life is really all about having some fun, making some memories, and most important of all, being in on the joke. Just when you thought you were finished with me, here I am again. I'm sharing these because I can, and because I love books, and because I love telling other people about great books to read. So I'll start with rock biographies, because as you will see, I'm a sucker for them. I'll Sleep When I'm Dead by Warren Zevon. A very flawed but very talented guy, sad in the end. Life by Keith Richards. He's a personal hero. Scar Tissue by Anthony Kiedis, a raw and crazy book. I think in trying to rationalize his awful behavior after the fact, he sounded almost worse, but still a good read. Slash by Slash. In contrast to Kiedis, he's just as insane, but just sort of owns it and shrugs. Love Slash. The Heroin Diaries by Nikki Sixx. I had just come off a New York City bender weekend and bought this in the airport. It was exactly what I needed. At least I wasn't as fucked up as this guy. I'll throw in the book The Dirt about the whole band Motley Crue, but Sixx's book was way more personal. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young by David Brown. I loved reading this. The band was one of the biggest in the world for a few years, and they all had huge egos and were extremely dysfunctional. A page-turner. I Must Say, My Life is a Humble Comedy Legend by Martin Short. His biography was so damn good. I learned a ton and laughed a lot and cried like a baby at the part where his longtime wife succumbed to cancer. I actually ran into him in LA a few months after reading the book and told him how much I loved it. He was super nice and asked me about myself. I have no idea what I said. He's a hero. Live from New York, the complete uncensored history of Saturday Night Live as told by its stars, writers, and guests. I blew through this book. It's amazing to hear all the people who have come through those doors tell their versions of events. Star, How Warren Beatty Seduced America by Peter Biskind. This guy bedded every starlet for 30 years in Hollywood, and he must have been good at it, because there was a new one waiting in the next room at all times. A legend. No One Here Gets Out Alive by Jerry Hopkins and Danny Sugarman. This one is about the Doors, and I read it in high school when I had a little obsession with Morrison. I loved how crazy he was one second and thoughtful the next. People hate on the Doors sometimes, but Jim was a total American original. Look Alive Out There by Sloane Crossley. My literary agent gave this book to me as inspiration, and I just fell in love with Sloane Crossley's writing style and sense of humor. So, in a way, she deserves a shout-out in Average Expectations. Monster, Living Off the Big Screen by John Gregory Dunn. It's an autobiography about the author and screenwriter trying to get his movie made and how much he gets trampled. It's both heartbreaking and hilarious. Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson. I read this twice. A fascinating and complex guy. Not all that nice at times, but a genius. Love the part where he's the CEO of both Apple and Pixar, negotiating billion-dollar deals on two fronts and absolutely kicking everyone's ass. Another American original. Barbarians at the Gate, When Genius Failed, and Liar's Poker. Three different books about insanely overconfident criminal Wall Street guys. Informative and eye-opening, whether you care about Wall Street or not. The Boys in the Boat, the true story of an American team's epic journey to win gold at the 1936 Olympics by Daniel James Brown. My mom gave this to me, and I wasn't sure I'd like it, but she was right. Again, it's about competitive rowing in the early 20th century, focusing on a particular guy and team. A wonderful story, and I couldn't believe how huge rowing used to be as a national sport. Not a Good Day to Die, The Untold Story of Operation Anaconda by Sean Naylor, about an early mission in Afghanistan. They were poised for victory until the higher-ups in Washington got involved and hundreds died because of people thousands of miles away and their thirst for glory. Open by Andre Agassi. I was a big Agassi fan growing up, and I still love tennis. Another really complex guy. He had some super low moments, but he persevered and went out a winner. Boys Will Be Boys and The Bad Guys Won by Jeff Perlman. Two books, one about the 1990s Dallas Cowboys and the other about the 1986 Mets. What a bunch of insane sports stories. Kitchen Confidential by Anthony Bourdain and Setting the Table by Danny Meyer. If you're interested in the restaurant business or if you wonder what happens behind the scenes as you sit at your table, read these. Jackpot by Jason Ryan. This takes place in South Carolina, and it's about some local guys smuggling pot from Jamaica. And instead of going to Miami like everyone else, they ran their business in the tidal creeks they all knew from childhood. One of the biggest drug investigations in history. As you can see, I love nonfiction, but here are a few fiction picks. Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry. My mom sat me down and promised me I'd love this book, even though it's about 900 pages long. Boy, was she right. So many rich and unique characters that you literally fall in love with from page one. The Prince of Tides by Pat Conroy. A simply wonderful book, and I think his best. Makes you laugh, cry, and ball up your fist in absolute anger. The brother is one of my favorite characters in fiction. To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. My absolute favorite hero of fiction is Atticus Finch, and I know I'm not alone in that. I wish all Southerners and perhaps humans in general would be mandated to read this year after year. Snow Falling on Cedars by David Gutterson. Just a beautiful love story. City of Thieves by David Benioff. Benioff is also co-creator and writer of Game of Thrones. This book is so lovely and inspiring. It's set behind German lines during World War II. Every single book, early ones especially, by John Irving. He's my mom's favorite writer, and she introduced me to his weird, quirky, and beautiful worlds and characters that he created. A few of my all-time favorites. A Prayer for Owen Meany, The World According to Garp, A Son of a Circus, very underrated and fascinating book, The Water Method Man, Water for Elephants by Sarah Gruen. Such a sweet and great story, made into a not-so-great film. Shogun by James Clavell. This book kicks ass. It's a long read about a Viking dude who is stranded in old world Japan. He's in a constant chess match with them while he learns their language and customs. Both sides are using each other, lots of intrigue. The Power of One by Bryce Courtenay. A cool story about a young boy becoming a boxer in South Africa. Uplifting and sometimes sad.
Average Expectations, Lessons in Lowering the Bar, was written by Shep Rose and read by the author. It was recorded by Michael Dalbello at Charleston Sound Studio in Charleston, South Carolina. Editing, mix, and post-production by Steven Strassman. The associate producer was Anna Chan. Average Expectations, Lessons in Lowering the Bar, was produced and directed by Randy Dolnick. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Average Expectations, Lessons in Lowering the Bar, is available in print from Gallery Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.